Stunned silence.
What is this?
We do the same. Right?
So it must be doing something. Right?
And it's playing its brain. Tell us what you
mean. Like, just,
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm. You're tuned to The 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 155 for October 2020. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Well, thanks, James. Happy October.
Oh, happy October to you, mate. Yes, into spring. Going well. We'll talk about that in a minute. And welcome back the lovely Anna. How are you, Anna?
Oh, I'm well, thank you.
Great to talk to you, and always good to talk to the one, the only, the Don. How are you, Don?
I'm very good, thank you.
Very good, mate. How's everyone doing? So is it like warming up over there in Canberra?
Oh, we had a nice cloudless sky today with 20 degrees, I think. It was,
yeah, we're starting nice. To get into the mid-20s on days, so yeah.
Lovely.
So in the sort of 70s for our Fahrenheit friends.
Fahrenheit friends. Nice. I'm going to call them now. I've got some Americans at work. I'm going to call my Fahrenheit friends. my Miles mates.
Your Imperial imposters or something.
Yes. No, good. Well, that's our 15th Station weather report. It's going quite well here in New Zealand as well. Spring is sprung or is springing. And we have, you know, blossoms on the trees and the flowers. It's all quite lovely, really. Plus,
I don't know where you were today because the weather was rubbish.
Yeah, it did turn a bit rubbish in the afternoon. I'll admit that. It was nice in the morning though. it's been pretty good the last couple of days, Don. I'm trying to.
I'm pretty sure we're both in Parnell for work. So.
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
I don't know where you were. Maybe the bottom of the hill is better.
Well, it's been over the last, you know, since the last podcast. I'm saying, like in the last month, the trend has been positive in the weather. The trend's been positive in COVID in New Zealand as well. Just to do our little COVID check-in, we need to have like a Chiron come across the virtual screen here. So we're back out of, we're in level one, not level none, as the Ministry of Health would like to point out. I know there's a number of, obviously there's a number of people around the world who are affected, but I would also, just a special prayers and encouragement to friend of the show, Father Roderick von Hogan, who has COVID, who's unwell with COVID and is hopefully, from what I was seeing, on recovering. If you're listening, Father, we hope that you and everyone else around the world who is suffering from this virus, or has friends and family who are, that you get to good health speedily. Yes.
Does President Trump listen? Because he's got it as well, obviously.
He is COVID free.
He's COVID.
Oh, is he?
I thought the COVID immune.
He's in fantastic health. Fantastic.
Well, speaking of fantastic, let's talk about the Pope's new encyclical. This is from Catholic News Service. Pope Francis's social encyclical sees the need for human fraternity as more than just an abstract concept, but as a concrete path towards peaceful coexistence in a world fraught by war, said Cardinal Pietro Parolin. I always struggle with his last name. At the Vatican's October 4th presentation of the encyclical Fratelli Tutti on Fraternity and Social Friendship, Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, said that the document shows that fraternity is not a trend or a fashion which develops over time or at a particular time, but rather is the result of concrete acts. In fact, if weapons and with them wars destroy human lives, the environment, and hope to the point of extinguishing the future of people and communities, he said. Dialogue destroys the barriers in the heart and mind, opens up spaces for forgiveness, and promotes reconciliation. In his address, Cardinal Parolin said that in today's international climate, there is an obvious contradiction between the common good and the tendency to give priority to the interests of states, even individual states. Citing the Pope's encyclical, Cardinal Parolin said that the result of this contradiction is that the multitude of the abandoned remain at the mercy of the possible goodwill of some. Fraternity is the exact opposite of this, he said. It introduces the idea of general interests, those capable of forming a true solidarity and of changing not only the structure of the international community, but also the dynamics of relationships within it. So, Gavin, Fratelli Tutti, has it been on your reading list? Have you had a chance to get through it yet, or if not,
I did.
You did? Oh, give us your encyclical review.
Oh, well, it's 4.3 stars.
Out of?
Oh, 5, I think.
Oh, ooh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. 86%, however you choose to slice it. No, I thought it was... It's one of those documents, and we live in this time of COVID, that sometimes things that weren't meant to have a particular COVID context end up having them anyway. And the encyclical was one of those things where this idea about human friendship is one that, and solidarity with one another is one that's become so front and center of our lives. When you look at, and we'll speak about an issue shortly, how people's mindsets can change based on the circumstances around them. How often people speak about, you know, something like euthanasia, and then when COVID comes along, all of a sudden there's a sense, oh, you know, we need to do everything we can to save people who have COVID, whether they're 99 or 7 or 41 or whatever age they are. We have to do everything we can to try and keep them alive. Yet there are all these other pushes in other contexts to say, oh, okay, well, human life isn't that important. And one of the things that's underlined for me is the ongoing and enduring message of human dignity that so runs through the encyclical, and how the church, as an organization founded by Christ, pushes for human dignity, how that message is timeless and often not really accepted. But an issue like COVID all of a sudden makes people think about something like human dignity in the context of those older people, or people who have COVID, or people who work on the front line, or people who drive delivery trucks, who often sort of cast aside and thought of as, you know, people who have a job that's not as important as some other jobs. And all of a sudden people like delivery drivers and cleaners and those sorts of people so critical to our well-being and to our ability to operate as a society. So many of the messages that come through for Tele 2T are ones that the church has held for time immemorial and have almost become trendy because of, or you know, more supported by the general population because of what COVID has taught us about our reliance on one another, reliance on God, if you know you're someone of that persuasion. And one of the things that the document speaks about is the importance of belief and that understanding of higher being, and having this approach, not suggesting that people who aren't Christian or aren't believers can't be good people, but that sense of that there's a greater calling when you have this understanding of belief, of faith, that you are called to act in a certain way, and here are the reasons why. That, you know, there's a very, well, there's a lengthy disposition on the parable of the Good Samaritan and how that's applied in today's context, which I found quite a useful thing, you know, and particularly to a parable that's so well known. People talk about Good Samaritan, many of them may not even know the background to it, but it's one of those stories that imbues everyday life from a Christian and Jewish then understanding of that story, and to put it in the context of COVID and the general contemporary realities of the world, I thought was a useful way to invite people into a conversation about friendship and fraternity and solidarity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point you raise, Gavin, about inadvertently being you know, COVID and things seen through that lens. But you know, at the same time, any kind of message of hope in these times is always welcome. Anna, what about you? Have you had a chance to read it, or have you been following some of the coverage of it? Where would you what are some of the key takeaways from what you've read so far?
Look, I have not had a chance to read it, but I plan to. Really, all I've seen is little snippets, paragraphs that people have posted on social media, and you know, obviously it's not, you know, one paragraph doesn't tell you everything that's in the encyclical, but certainly there's what I've seen so far. There are things like it makes me want to read it and see sort of how they are, what context, you know, those the topics that he's talking about, like how he, the context in which he's writing them. So yeah, I mean, I don't, my husband has given quite a good spiel. Maybe I don't need to read it anymore. I'll just
just get the Gavin Cliff Notes version.
But
they used to call me Cliff.
No, Cliff Notes. Did they? Yeah, that's very good.
But yeah, I think it's good to, whether you're a fan of Francis or not, to read it, and because I think it's dangerous to just see little snippets and think somehow you've got a grasp of what he's actually trying to get at. But yeah, certainly I think what Gavin was saying, that idea of, you know, how in some respects this encyclical has probably been in the works for a long time, but it comes out at a time when, you know, this is a good discussion to be having about fraternal solidarity and things like that. And I was actually thinking, like, they use the word dialogue a lot. And I remember, you know, like 10 or 15 years ago, maybe dialogue was the word. We have to have dialogue with everyone. It's all, you know, and we've sort of lost that. We don't really dialogue anymore. We just shut people down, cancel culture, all that kind of stuff, right? Like, that's sort of our MO at the moment, and what happens a lot. And maybe that's the influence of social media and stuff like that. But, you know, having true dialogue, not just I want to have a space where I can voice my opinions, but true dialogue is I want to actually listen to someone else's and understand them. And yeah,
there's quite long sections in there. Actually, he cites the Bishops of Australia, who put a document out last year on social media. But yeah, there is quite a bit about, around that anti-social media and that phenomenon in the document. If that tickles one's fancy or piques one's interest, there's a fair bit about that.
Does it pique your interest, Don? I mean, I can't really comment. I'm a Pope behind. I only just read Deus Caritas Est over the weekend. So I've got a little bit way to go before I catch up to Fratelli Tutti. But what's your take on what you've heard so far about the encyclical?
Oh, I've read a little bit of it. There's some good parts. So it's there's an emphasis on the destructive role of moral relativism, which other popes have touched on as well, which was good. There was a good section on forgiveness, I think, which was quite apt in today's society, where you have people running around saying that people should be angry for things that other people's ancestors did 250 years ago, or things that people did in their past, like 300 years ago. For example, Lincoln, who may have not been the perfect gentleman, but certainly deserves his place in history given what he has achieved. But there are certain people who want to bring up his sins and his failures, which I think is not good. And it's not good for, it's not good for society. And really, we should have that spirit of forgiveness in our hearts. I think probably what I would criticize, and that's probably something around Francis generally, that any of his economics or his economic commentary seems to come from a worldview where only, you know, somewhere between a neo-Keynesian and neo-Marxist, they basically, and someone who hates fossil fuels, that's the only legitimate kind of economic theory, and if you're outside of that, that's somehow bad. Whereas I think some balance with, you know, some more kind of right-wing economic theory might be a little bit more balanced, given the capitalist system that we live in today's brought, you know, empirically millions and millions and millions and billions out of poverty, and is responsible, and fossil fuels, and responsible for the standards of livelihoods and
the poverty alleviation that we've experienced in the last kind of 100 years, because we'd probably still have mortality rates. People be dying in the 30s if we haven't had that kind of revolution. So, just a little bit of balance there.
Well, I think, balance is one of those things I guess we've got to sort of look for in any of the popes. I mean, I don't know how much I would turn to encyclical for economic advice, but I think in some of the moral aspects of things, it seems to have been relatively well received in all corners. I don't think there's such thing as a perfect encyclical anyway. But it's definitely on my reading list, and I say that because, as I say, I only just read Pope Benedict's on the weekend, so I've got a few to get through.
One other interesting point I might raise, if I might, Mr. Chair, was around, particularly again this time of COVID, there's been a lot of necessary financial support, stimulus, whatever you want to call it, for people who haven't been able to work. One of the points that the Pope makes and is around the value of work and essentially this idea that financial support for people who need it is important and should happen, but that there is an inherent value and a dignity for people who go out and work and find meaning in what it is that they do. And I think sometimes there can be a misunderstanding of that. I think it's a very important message that I found in the document that I think was just worth noting. That sense that while there are people for whom work is not possible because of particular mental or physical health challenges, that for those who can work, there's not only a financial consequence from being able to do that. There's a almost a moral and spiritual benefit from doing that. And I just thought that was an interesting point that I would note.
Yes, well noted. Well noted. Speaking of note, or what rhymes with note? Vote. From NZ Catholic, New Zealand's Catholic bishops are urging voters to say no to the euthanasia referendum, and ask that voters give, quote, serious thoughts to the effect of cannabis on vulnerable young people when considering the cannabis referendum. The six bishops made those calls in their 2020 election statement, which also urges people to consider the poor and vulnerable when voting, but expressly says it is not the bishop's role to tell people who to vote for. Urging a no vote in the End of Life Choice Act referendum, the bishops state that the demand for euthanasia is driven not by pain, but by personal and emotional factors such as fear of being a burden or being disabled, fears that reflect negative attitudes towards the elderly and disabled that run deep in society. They note that key medical groups, including the New Zealand Medical Association, have opposed the End of Life Choice Act and have criticised the act for not requiring that people first access palliative care when it is available. On the recreational cannabis referendum, the bishop stated that as proprietors of many of the country's 237 Catholic schools, with 66,000 students, they are keenly aware that young people are the group most vulnerable to the negative effects of cannabis. Quote, "We think people do need to give serious thoughts to the issue, and we hope that you will use your vote in a way that considers the impact of legalized recreational cannabis on the young and vulnerable in our communities." In the main section of their statement, the bishops asked, "What kind of nation do we want after the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic and its ongoing consequences?" Quote, "We hope and work for a nation that looks to ensure the sanctity and well-being of whānau, that ensures families have time to spend with each other, that supports all families to access the basic human needs of food, clothing, housing, education, and healthcare, rather than thinking about what will benefit each of us personally regarding the election and referendum choices we face. We ask you to pray and discern what will protect the poor and vulnerable and what will uphold the dignity of creation so that we create a connected future for all without discarding any of us." Right, let's see if we can have a conversation about politics without it all going to somewhere. We'll start with Anna, because we'll start high class. We'll end with me. I'll try and get us right out of it or into it, depending on which way you look at it. So, Anna, the bishop's election statement, I'm keen for your thoughts. whether you want to talk about the euthanasia referendum or the cannabis referendum or just their position on voting in general, what's your sort of take? Will you be voting? You'll be voting.
Oh yes.
We need to do that.
We do need to do that.
We do need to get onto that. Yes.
Yeah.
We've got our papers.
Yeah, we just need to lodge them.
Well, but, what's your thought on let's start with what your thoughts are on the Bishop's statement in general.
Look, I think obviously the encouragement to vote no on the euthanasia is, I'm glad that they've said that and said that clearly. I was interested with their sort of non-committal instructions or advice or whatever as far as the cannabis one goes, but I suppose that's not a matter of sort of doctrine or something like that, like the euthanasia bill is. It's perhaps somewhat, I don't know, less kind of clear cut, but certainly pointing out the fact that, and that's I think the reality. Well actually the final bit that you read out, James, about their encouragement to think beyond your own needs when voting. So it's interesting because with the debate around the euthanasia bill and even the cannabis stuff, there's a lot of people speaking from like, I want to have the autonomy to do this. Like I want to have the freedom to be able to do this, but there's no thought about how that might impact other people, so that they might be in a situation where they might be able to freely choose without being coerced or without being sort of in a position where that's like their only choice, or will they feel like it's their only choice or something like that, or they're a vulnerable person in a circumstance where they don't have good family support or whatever, and they turn to drugs to kind of help them get through life. And that's not ideal. We don't want that. And so to encourage people, and not just in those circumstances, but even in the circumstances of, the wider scope, like sort of social welfare, the possibility of jobs for all, because that's a good thing, not just for the economy, but for our own well-being and health and education and all that, and not just for I'm not just voting for myself, but I have in mind the rest of my fellow country persons, and what do I see would be good for all, not just for me. I think that's quite good because, a lot of people really like our current Prime Minister, and it scares me that, and okay, I'm not a fan, I'll be honest about that, but partly I'm not a fan of hers because I don't like the policies, and I don't like actually just that they haven't really delivered what they said that they would deliver. And we vote people in order to get the things that we need. So I feel like the government hasn't really done a good job. So even if I thought our current Prime Minister had, was a nice person and a good communicator, which perhaps all those things are true, she's not just there to be a nice person and a communicator. Mm. She's there to lead a government, to get things done in our country, to improve our lot. And I'm not sure, but people are so caught up in perhaps her personality and things like that. And I think I've said this before on this podcast that, I think we have to, that's a dangerous place to get into, because we have to think, like, is this actually good for the rest of the country and for everybody, especially with a slightly more left-leaning government, you would expect that they have a bit more of a social welfare, social justice bent, and that perhaps things like poverty and things like that will improve under them, but it hasn't. And so we have to call them to account for that, and we shouldn't just be voting a government in based on personality. So the fact that I sort of see it going that way is concerning. So the fact that the bishops have kind of perhaps drawn our attention to the fact that we shouldn't just be voting for what we think is good for us, but it's got to be good for everybody as well. So I was happy to see that in there.
I like also your distinction there about the difference between obviously the euthanasia bill being an issue of serious moral peril, and the cannabis legislation having also negative effects, no doubt about it, and there being considerations of that. But it's interesting how you draw that distinction between how strongly the bishops speak against the euthanasia bill and then how they're a little bit more, not reticent, but a little bit more, well, this is less of a moral issue when it comes to the cannabis legislation. Yet the government hasn't stopped doing the same thing, because it's funny, or not funny, it's tragic, that we're staring into something here, Don, with two referendums. I always thought it was a referenda, but apparently it's referendums. Two referendums, one of which on an issue of life and death and morality, the referendum is asking, do you support a bill going into law? Which I find the question phrasing, we've talked before on the podcast and we'll keep talking about it, although Election Day is this coming Saturday, so we probably won't talk about it. Well, let's see what we talk about afterwards. But that's the question, right? The question of the referendum is, do you support the End of Life Choice Act going into force? Which is ridiculous, because most people will not read the act, because we don't make it a general part of our day. That's why we pay politicians hundreds of thousands of dollars. And yet the and is binding, right? So that's the, if it goes yes, then it's into effect. Whereas the cannabis one is, do you support cannabis? What is it? But there's not legislation that's been drafted. So the thing which is actually talking about like management of a prohibited substance, which the government does all the time, actually, no, we haven't got a law for that yet. And if you say yes, then we'll go look at drafting a law. The thing that they should be weighing, staying out of, issues of morality, they've got the law drafted in 24 pages and they're going to make it go into effect. What's your sort of take on either any of that, Don, or the Bishop's statement in general?
I guess on the referendum question, specifically on euthanasia, I mean, the New Zealand law is one of the weakest and the one with the least protections in the world. You look at the other jurisdictions that have euthanasia and they're certainly stronger. If you've got weaker protections than the likes of Canada and Victoria, that's really not a good place to be starting. Surprisingly, Victoria is actually not that weak in terms of some of the protections. For example, having a kind of independent witness there and protections in place to make sure that the person isn't being coerced or bullied in any way and is making a free decision. So those types of protections and being free from mental illness, that kind of thing. None of those checks and balances are in place in the New Zealand law, which makes it one of the worst laws in the world. And I think people should be aware of that when they're going to the voting booth, because that is the specific law that we are voting for. On the bishops, I actually feel we're in a stage where it's very critical things that we're voting on. And I actually think they've misinterpreted, or I've got a different view to how they've interpreted canon law. Because canon law states that priests shouldn't, except in very extreme circumstances, take political office. And I see that as very different from priests advocating a certain party or favouring parties, one or the other. And sure, you can read between the lines in terms of what the bishops are saying and make your own conclusions. But my preference would be that they're stronger than that. And they came out and say, hey, and I truly believe this, as a Catholic, you cannot vote Labour, you cannot vote Greens, you cannot vote ACT. So those are parties who have pushed policies that are in direct contradiction to what we believe and the values that we believe in as Catholics. And I guess with my Catholic friends, the only real debate, and I guess this is a good space to be in, is whether you should be voting new conservative or national, which isn't perfect in its pro-life stance, but it is majority conservative, and it is the only source of conservative values given New Zealand First won't be there next time. So I guess I'm arguing with them to not waste their vote on New Conservative, given that New Conservative won't make the 5% threshold. And in practice, they're really just giving half their vote to Labour Greens.
It's interesting. I mean, there's been plenty of discussion amongst friends of mine as well. The Māori Party has also been put forward around when you recognise some of their policies very strong on pro-life and some other things as well. You know, it's interesting because as we talked some of this on previous episodes of the podcast. It becomes quite challenging when you start realising that, you know, the leaders of both parties have voted in favour of the abortion legislation, voted in favour of the final reading of the euthanasia legislation. And you are left with this kind of, you know, between the devil and the deep blue sea when it comes to our parties, because we don't have quite separation.
Yeah, but my point around the leaders is that under our parliamentary system, it's not the leaders that matter, it's the caucus that matters.
Right.
And if you look at the national caucus, the leaders, their power comes from the caucus. And if you look at how the national caucus has voted and the abortion legislation, 2/3 of them voted against the legislation, where you had 80% of Labour voting for the legislation. So you can characterise National as the most pro-life party that's going to be there after the election. With any good chance of having seats in the House.
That's the important corollary, right? Because what we've actually got is the least worst option when we look at the major parties, right?
That is the only least...
You
look at who's left after the option. New Zealand First won't be there. It is the only Conservative voice that will be in Parliament in 2021.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing, right, Gavin? Like, when it comes to this, when it comes to the bishops making their comments and sort of getting us to, you know, consider all of these things and to pray and discern, Anna's raised some good points there about the praying and thinking beyond yourself and beyond you and into society. And I guess, and Don, that's your point as well, right, is looking at the voting record and looking at what these parties represent. What's your take, Gavin, can I ask, like, on the referendum, and just a correction, sorry, because I clicked on the wrong link. There is a bill that's drafted for the cannabis referendum. What it's the difference between the two, and that's what I was trying to say before, is the question for the cannabis one is, do you support the proposed bill, like cannabis legalization and control bill? Whereas the euthanasia one is, do you support the End of Life Choice Act coming into force?
Yeah.
And so the binding referendum on euthanasia and the not binding referendum on cannabis legalization and control bill, the challenge I reckon is, if you walk through, and I have done this, you ask the average person, you know, and your family and your friends on the street, have you read either one of these bills? And the answer will nearly invariably be no. They haven't read them. They've read commentary on them. They've read summary on them. They've read various political parties' take on them. They may have used the votesafe.nz website and it sort of told them some aspects of it, but nobody's actually read the legislation. There's an interesting point at our parish. We had a local doctor sort of running through it weekend before last, and his point was the Australian legislation, I think Victoria, where Victoria has euthanasia but not assisted suicide, and the bill that went that for that law was like 147 pages. In New Zealand, we are talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide, and it's 24 pages long. And it's like, so either the Australian system is far more verbose unnecessarily, or it turns out this very, very complicated issue is getting a once over lightly and then kind of rammed through in a binding referendum, not wanting to get the witness at all. What are your thoughts,
Kevin? Yeah, well, not that I was wanting to dispute the chairs earlier. I was looking at the information about the referenda. I'm going to say referenda.
It should be referenda, right? It should be referenda.
Yes, it should. And just saying, if you actually click through, there's not an obvious place to go and read the cannabis bill.
No.
There's all these things. What does the bill say? Oh, here's two paragraphs about what it says. Okay. I actually think my take on it is, and I say this as somebody who has worked a little bit in this field, I think the comments from the bishop make it quite clear how people should vote on the cannabis legislation, basically saying, this is dangerous for young people. We've got lots of young people. you should think about young people when you're casting your vote. Like, to me, the logic is, okay, if you don't care about young people, then you can vote to support it. But if you do, you should vote against it. So to my mind, I think they're pretty clear in their views. But as Anna pointed out and others have said, you know, there are different moral statuses between the two bits of legislation. So I think the I think last I saw polls are, you know, to be completely trusted, as we've known for the last several years. But the last poll I think I saw suggested that the euthanasia referendum is likely to pass, but the cannabis one likely to fail. Now, that was me being sarcastic before about polls, obviously. So so I'm not sure what's going to end up happening, but I think both of them would be retrograde steps for my country, even though I live in another one at the moment. And I know it's seen as progressive policies, both of them, but I think that they are anything but, and at the risk of publicly stating how I plan to vote, at least on the two referenda, I can safely say that I'll be voting no on both of those, and I'll leave my other votes to my own understanding. But and I think the election result at the moment feels like it's only heading in one direction, but we just never know. And the New Zealand system allows for some curious results on election night, and then potentially curious results in the formation of a government and therefore the parliament. So it's I'm sure we'll talk about something on the next episode. We may not talk about the referenda, but we'll certainly be talking about the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I guess before we move on to the next topic, I guess, you know, as I've said on the podcast, you know, regular listeners will know that I have a somewhat allergic reaction to a lack of logic. Like, I actually don't have a problem with people who disagree with me. I have a problem if you can't logically state your argument and tell me how you got to that conclusion. Because
I'm anxious about where this is going.
No. Genuinely, I'd like to learn from people, and it's kind of hard to learn when there's just no logic to their thing, right? But the other thing I'm finding that with our politicians in particular, that I'm finding frustrating. Let's go with that word, frustrating, is the selective nature by which they use things such as referendums. Binding or non-binding. Like, I have not seen any, there was no proposal put forward by the Labour Party in government this year for a binding referendum on whether or not they should increase taxes next year. They didn't put that out to everyone going, what does everyone think about, should we increase taxes this year? Now, the argument of all the parties is, well, we put our policies out before the election, and the referendum, which is actually the vote, if you vote us in, you vote us in for our policies. But as you point out, Gavin, the curious nature of how politics works in New Zealand. No, you can't guarantee that at all, because the way the coalitions work, and plus politicians, I think it's okay to say that they lie, although I did have to have a wee chuckle to myself when David Seymour, which is the, for those overseas listeners, is the ACT Party leader, who's the guy behind the euthanasia bill. When the bishops put out their election statement, he told them they should be making sure that they are obeying the ninth commandment. And I'm like, what? They should be what now? And his point was, and I'm not making this up, did you guys see this?
Yeah.
That they should not be bearing false witness against their neighbor in their representation of the bill, of what the bill actually covers off. And I'm like, I listened to an interview with him, and I'm like, what's the false witness here, buddy? Like, what is he saying? Misrepresenting what? There's nothing about, they said the same thing about the Vote Safe NZ thing. And I'm like, no, what you don't like is that when the facts of your bill are played out to people, it actually reads for pretty, you know, macabre and somewhat twisted and evil. And people are like, and I've had, you know, friends and family who have been very much in support, or not even very much, they're kind of on the line. And then you say, do you realize the bill says this, this, and this? And they're like, what? No, it doesn't. And you're like, no, it really does. And that's not misinformation, Mr. Seymour. That is actually the information in your bill. Yet, that's the kind of thing we put in front of everyone. So all these other things, we don't turn around and say whether or not we should, you know, increase taxes or
abortion.
Abortion, let's not put that out to everyone. Let's not put any of these other moral issues. Oh, so
no, even worse, the abortion one, let's sneak it in before COVID while no one's watching.
Yeah, exactly. It's so crazy. Crazy.
Evil.
It's the kind of stuff which in the lead up to, you know, an election makes you want to pray harder and pray more. And that includes apparently if you are the leader of the opposition. This is from stuff.co.nz. Judith Collins wouldn't say what she prayed for while kneeling in a Tāmaki church on October the 4th, but you might guess it was for fewer votes to go to minor parties on the right. Yeah, okay. The National
News section, I think. News.
Views and news. The National leader's faith has been something of a revelation on the campaign trail this week. It came up during the TVNZ debate when she said, "As a Christian, I do believe in miracles," at a Grey Power meeting in Nelson, and when she chose to pray before voting. Collins won't confirm it, but from the outside, her emphasising of faith appears to be part of a broader strategy to claim votes from minor parties, particularly those to which National supporters may have strayed. Arriving at St. Thomas Anglican Church in Tāmaki to cast her vote, Collins was invited by Reverend Bob Driver to pray. Collins, speaking to reporters outside, declined to discuss what was on her mind in the church. "That's between me and God, actually," she said. I can just picture her saying that too. Asked about why she chose to pray in front of the cameras, she said the media hadn't been invited, though Collins didn't seek privacy as she led the media pack into the building, and a media handler checked with church staff that it was okay for cameras to enter. Collins pushed back against a question about whether she was playing up her faith to appeal more to Christian voters who may have drifted from National. Quote, "If you look at my maiden speech 18 years ago, you'll see that right in there, I declared that I believe in God. I still do." Don, what was your take on this, mate? Like, did you know that Judith Collins is a practicing, I'm guessing, Anglican? Oh, well, Christian. I don't know what denomination. Was this surprising? And what did you sort of take of the photo op?
It was surprising given her voting record. And I understand, you know, National is a big umbrella for people who are fiscally conservative. But there is a spectrum of conservatism in terms of their social values. But if you look at the voting record, the majority of them, or you know, more than two-thirds of them, would be probably socially conservative based on the voting record. Judith's voting record would be on the socially less conservative side, so it did come as a surprise. I don't think it was a good campaign move. I think it probably turned a lot of Christians off rather than, yeah, I've always been, well, I haven't always been, but certainly this election, and with National being the only party with a legitimate chance of representation in the next parliament, and they will be the only people with a conservative voice in that parliament, I'm certainly voting for them and supporting them, but I don't think this was a good move for them. I just don't think it was genuine. If it was someone else, Maggie Barry, Simon O'Connor, Simon Brown, Melissa Lee, any of those, I would be much happier. But with Judith, no.
It's one of those things where I think, you know, Gavin, particularly, I have to say the parallels will be drawn with a certain world leader who may or may not have, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I sort of go to church, I don't usually have it preceded by tear gas, nor do I stand out the front of it holding a Bible. I mean, I kind of, the visual and, you know, checking in, can the people take photos and stuff like that? I mean, and, you know, what was your take, mate? What do you think? Do you think this is a good idea? I mean, it's always a good idea to pray. Let's just get that clear. It's always a good idea to pray. I'm not going to say that's not a good idea. Do you think the particular manner with which this was done was a good idea?
Well, if it's true, and I have no reason to doubt the truthiness of this particular part of the story, that she was invited sort of spontaneously to go in, as opposed to she put on her media engagement schedule, pray at St. Thomas's Church, whatever it was called. I think that is a little bit different. I don't politically, electorally, I think it was an important thing to try and attract the Christian vote. I'm not sure this is the best way to do it, But to Don's point earlier about voting for Christian parties, if you want to call them that, or parties that are that uphold Christian values, that frankly have zero chance of making, well, 2% chance or 1% chance of making it into the parliament, half of that vote, essentially under the MMP system, goes to the Greens and Labor. So if you're choosing to vote for a conservative Christian-based party that doesn't make it, your vote is, in a sense, wasted, or you could argue half of it goes there. Whereas if that vote were cast for National, who will get into Parliament, you could see it as a vote that is fully going to support a party that, as Don has clearly outlined, overall has a more conservative bent. So the attempt to draw voters from those minor parties to National does help overall, if that's the end result of your attempt to attract Christian voters. But in the New Zealand context, I don't remember even Bill English, who would probably be the most religious prime minister we've had in the last generation anyway, since Jim Bolger probably. I don't remember him going down this path. Now, he was more overt about his faith. I've met Judith Collins many, many years, well, 12, 15 years ago, and so I knew she had a Christian background. And frankly, I was surprised she voted the way she did on abortion, because I know in the past she has voted more conservatively on some issues like around parental notification and those sorts of bits of legislation. So I knew she was Christian, but I'm also aware that it hasn't necessarily been a major part of her profile, whereas for some MPs, their faith is both part of their private life, but it's manifested in the way their public life unfolds as well. So she's not one of those. So this was a bit of a more public display of it. And my sense is that it's probably backfired ultimately, but that the logic of trying to attract those voters, that Stuff managed to crack that code in their reporting. I think the idea was a worthy one, but probably the execution is going to backfire.
Yeah, if she was going to try, she probably should have tried in some church in Otara or Mangere, where you do have Pacific Christian communities, but where their communities are overwhelmingly Labour supporters. So probably wrong district to try that.
Yeah, probably showed up to a Sunday service.
I still don't think it would have. I don't think it would have played. Like, I look at this and go, and Anna, I'm really keen for your thoughts on this. If you go through the list of MPs, to Gavin's point, you know, those that actually manifest their, their faith, regardless of whether it's election year or not, those who for whom they're known, and I'm not just talking Catholic. I'm talking people who, you know, it is known that that is an important part of who they are. There are plenty of people who would tick the box as Christian of some description, and yet haven't voted anyway near the way that we would hope that they would, based on what we believe. So something like this, if it was genuinely a personal moment, that it was being the people were like shooting in through the stained glass windows and they see the silhouette of Judith Collins praying, that's one thing. But this kind of looked kind of staged. So I don't know, what's your sort of take on the whole thing?
Well, I think that maybe it was a bit of a faux pas so the media is the one, like the media has let us know, like Stuff and probably the television news. They're the ones who promote, like told us that this happened, right? Because most of us weren't there. And obviously the media is a lot more the darling of the current PM. And so to me, they've certainly portrayed it as a little bit of like, oh, that was a, you're trying a bit too hard there. And whether she was or not, I don't know, because I don't know what was in her heart or, and I don't know anything about her particular Christian faith or anything. But I thought that she probably just took an opportunity. But if you're really going to be savvy and cunning, you're not going to allow those certain circumstances to be played in a bad way for you by the media, right? Because that's what the media is going to do. And so, yeah, I think letting them in was the
was the
not really thought through. And maybe she's put on the spot, and so she just thought, oh, this is an opportunity. But the media is not going to be kind to her, that, and so she has to remember that. And and the people who hold their Christian faith as something really important to them are going to know what her voting record is. So just because she prays for 5 minutes in a church won't undo her voting record. Mm. So I think if she's trying to get the Christian vote, as what's already been commented on, you know, that wasn't the way.
Yeah,
and just doing it. But that's speculation too, right?
Well, this is like the thing. I mean,
speculation from stuff.
That's so unlike a media organisation. I was reading a book at the weekend, which made a comment. It was a parenting book actually, but it made a comment that I think is relevant, which said, you know, be careful ascribing ill motives to someone, because actually figuring out what someone's true motives are is one of the hardest things to do, including sometimes yourself. Figuring out what your motives are. So I kind of look at this and say, well, from a political point of view, if interpreted as a political stunt, probably not the best idea. If genuinely this is how, you know, she took the opportunity and the invitation was there and she was praying, well, good on her. You know, good on her. And I would just kind of hope, given some of her recent votes, regardless of the nature of the election, that I would hope that if she is open to the Spirit, that the Spirit moves her to vote and more in favor of life. There we go. That's my thoughts on it. Right, let's go around the world for a little bit of intrigue. Now, with this story, we're going to cover it off because it's still a developing story. I saw there was some more stuff on Crux today. So we'll talk a little bit about it, but I want to caveat the whole thing by we're not trying to throw around scandal or things like that. Yeah, we're just trying to talk about what is in the news. And this is from The Australian. By the way, I've thought of this a few times in previous episodes, Gavin, for our international listeners, for our Miles mates, our, what would you call them?
Fahrenheit friends.
When we say from The Australian, that's the name of a newspaper. It's not like just a random Australian. Like, we haven't just like found like an Australian, the Aussie, and gone, oh, that one, that guy said it. So from The Australian, authorities should investigate allegations that an Italian cardinal used Vatican funds to corrupt the sexual abuse case leveled against Cardinal George Pell, according to his former defense barrister. Robert Richter QC said claims that more than $1.1 million in church money was used as a bribe should be independently examined. Three prominent Italian newspapers have reported that Cardinal Giovanni Becciu, a rival of Cardinal Pell, was suspected of paying the money to influence the failed case against him. Viv Waller, the lawyer representing the complainant, said he had not received any of the money allegedly sent from the Vatican. No evidence confirming the plot has been furnished by Cardinal Becciu's accusers. Mr. Richter said the allegations were serious and should be investigated by authorities with the capacity to track money. Victoria Police has not received a complaint about the money transfers, which have further scandalized the Vatican and coincided with Cardinal Pell's return to Rome. Cardinal Becciu had strongly denied any wrongdoing. Italian newspapers have reported that Cardinal Becciu is suspected of arranging €700,000 to be sent to unnamed people in Australia to ensure unfavourable evidence against Cardinal Pell. Cardinal Pell, as we all know, was jailed for more than a year after being wrongly convicted of abusing two Melbourne choir boys at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne in the mid-1980s. The High Court quashed the conviction in April and Cardinal Pell was freed. Cardinal Becciu was forced to resign by Pope Francis last month as Vatican investigators sifted through his spending record at the Secretariat of State. So what do we make of all this, Gavin? It's kind of crazy listening to all these things that are going on around the world. But in particular, given what we've covered with the Cardinal Pell case, what do we make of the Cardinal Becciu situation?
Well, I mean, certainly I think he might deny certain things. He might deny all the things. But the fact that he's resigned and there's been so much swirling around with this, you know, these apartments and or apartment building in London and all sorts of things. I think there's far too much going on I think the idea that some people at the Vatican were behind the Cardinal Pell charges, I'm not sure if we've canvass that theory on this podcast before. We may have. Certainly, it's been floating around for a long time, in so much as, you know, Cardinal Pell was the brash Australian brought in to try and clean up the corrupt Vatican finances. And the feeling among some Italian journalists and other commentators was that he was probably doing too good a job, maybe in cleaning things up, and therefore there was a desire that he no longer continue his process. Now, I've been one, and I think we have spoken about it on the podcast, that has struggled to ascribe such ulterior motives to more than one group of people. It's, you know, you can say, well, there are people at the Vatican who wanted X to happen, and there are people in Victoria who wanted Y to happen, and there are enough people in both places to try and get both X and Y to happen, that they conspired together to try and achieve it. In the case of Cardinal Pell and the charges of which he was eventually acquitted. So there is a lot of speculation, and we ought not assume, as we've just been doing with the Stuff's reporting of the leader of the opposition in New Zealand, where the truth lies. But certainly I would support the idea from Cardinal Pell's lawyer that, and another number of other people have made this point, that there's enough here that there needs to be an investigation to try and understand what might have happened. And it may turn out that the Cardinal Pell trial, there's nothing related to that. And in a sense, that would be the best outcome because to think that that was what was going on would really make you question even more things than we already find need to. But, you know, well, they say disinfectant is the best.
Sunlight is the best.
Sunlight's the best disinfectant. Yeah. I knew there was something about disinfectant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, you know, I'll say the same. I mean, I wouldn't even possibly put it on the same level. I have to say these accusations versus the accusations that Cardinal Pell faced. But Anna, you know, if Cardinal Becciu is innocent, I hope he's proven as such. I mean, it's one of these things where you go, and I genuinely mean that, this isn't good for the church, seeing this kind of movement around of, you know, it just further plays into some of the stereotypes. This is millions of dollars moving between church charities, supposedly, and for paying consultants hundreds of thousands of dollars, and all this kind of thing. And you go, well, even if some of that stuff is legitimate, it actually is still not a good look for the church. It's not the kind of the church that we want to be putting forward, and not the kind of church, quite frankly, that I really am very proud of. But what did you sort of make of the Becciu story?
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually felt really sad, especially because what I heard first was the stuff related to Cardinal Pell's trial. And I just thought, man, those guys really need to read Fratelli Tutti, right? Like, you know, anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I felt really sad because these guys are brothers in Christ. And I know, like, not everyone gets along. Like, I'm not sort of trying to, but, you know, that one cardinal perhaps allegedly, you know, was involved in a very underhanded, despicable thing against another cardinal. But I mean, the thing is that this is not new to the church. That what happens in the Vatican is perhaps not something that the church can be proud of, or some things that happen in the Vatican are not for us to be proud of. So in the 2000 years that we've been around, there's been a lot of that stuff going on. And one of the things that Francis was meant to do when he came in was to clean everything up. And I think, you know, he's certainly made some steps in that direction. And there has been, especially when not just relating to sexual abuse stuff, but when it's, you know, perhaps misappropriation of funds and things like that, like, you know, things like that are coming to our attention and they're hopefully being dealt with. So, you know, being investigated and publicly investigated. So, that's a good thing because, yes, we do need those things out and about. There was something written about, because they've, you know, certainly in this article from The Australian, they talk about Betcher as being the Pope's, Pell's nemesis. And the reason that he was talked of in that way, that they had this conflict, was that Pell had organized an audit of the Vatican finances, and an independent audit. And then he had to come back to Australia to face the allegations. And Betchu cancelled that audit. So I knew that that had happened. And then now all these allegations, okay, I'm not saying they're true and I don't know and it's not my place to say that they're true. But you wonder why does he cancel an audit if he's got nothing to hide? And he wasn't, and he convinced the Pope to cancel it. So the Pope agreed. And so that's kind of disappointing, I think. But anyway, we don't know the ins and outs. And the politics there is pretty crazy, I imagine. So hopefully, you know, if he is someone who shouldn't be where he is, then that's a good step, that, you know, we're taking steps to, and maybe that's a lesson for other cardinals and bishops and archbishops, that they can't get away with stuff like this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, Don, what do you make of all this, mate? Do you get a bit of a sense of, I don't know, Christ making a court and driving the moneylenders out of the temple forecourt at all? Or do you think there's something else going on? What's your sort of take?
To Gavin's point, due process needs to be done. Like, you know, at the start of the Pell trial, that's what we called for from the justice system, for due process. And we called for that for Pell, and we should really hold ourselves to that same standard and wait for the process to play itself off and the evidence to come forward and the investigations to take place before we make any calls or speculate in any way. I think that's the right thing to do. For me, it makes... if the allegations are true, there's some sense in the Pell story, because for me it doesn't make a lot of sense that the Victorian police would come out and just put a full page ad looking for stories of criminal activities from the cathedral where no complaint had been laid. So if the allegations are found to be true, and if there is a link, in my mind, that makes a more realistic story than what actually played out in real life.
I definitely think it's an important point that we would underscore as we finish the story, is that it's important due process is carried out, and exactly that, what, you know, we would be hypocrites if we didn't call for exactly the same treatment for all these kind of crises. And I think that things like independent audits by non-Catholic organizations, I think like independent investigators and people who don't have vested interests being involved in whether it's financial matters or whether it's some of the far more, you know, the grave abuse claims, I think that's the only way that the sunlight disinfectant that you were promising before, Gavin, can actually be deployed. So I think with this, a cautionary note around, a number of us were quite, well, we've talked about on the podcast, kind of surprised at the circumstances that led to Pell's accusation, conviction, and then obviously having it overturned. But let us not rush to judgment in case we make the same mistake in a different way.
But if it does come out to be true, then some people really need to spend a lot of time in jail.
If it comes out to be true, we will be covering it here. That is for sure. With far less. We'll watch closely. We will watch closely. Even if we are operating at reduced capacity, we will still watch closely. Speaking of reduced capacity, this one from the Daily Mail. Church.
Nice.
A church in Louisiana that reopened at reduced capacity amid the coronavirus came up with a divinely funny way to maintain social distancing. When Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New Orleans opened at 10% occupancy, Pastor Ray Canata outfitted several of the pews with signs directing worshippers to sit elsewhere and stay 6 feet apart. Each of the signs has a humorous Bible referencing message, including, "Jesus sat the 5,000 down in rows, but not this one." Or, reserved for Elijah only. I like that one, that's good. They have arranged for there to be 20 feet between each person using ushers and funny signs to keep things spaced out. "Things feel really grim right now," Canata told CNN, "so we printed up the signs to give people something to smile about. People are coming into the church to worship and celebrate, but they're worried about getting sick or making someone else sick. Everyone's wearing masks and giving each other space. It's all stuff we aren't accustomed to at all, so this just helps lighten the mood." The signs all referenced God or specific biblical passages or figures. Quote, "Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and if he were here today, he wouldn't be allowed to sit in this pew," reads one. "I have prepared a place for you," one sign reads, quoting John 14:3, "just not this pew." Oh, that's quite clever. It's quite good. I mean, you've got to try and have you know, we've got sort of bits of cord and rope separating out our pews to sort of say you can't sit in these ones.
But maybe I just came up with one myself.
Go on. What's your COVID warning in biblical pun?
Yeah, okay. "Let he who is without sin sit in this pew."
Nice.
Now, maybe in that story, and I've sort of subconsciously remembered it and think that I'm brilliant for coming up with it, but I just came up with it then, I think.
That's very good.
Or I remembered it from somewhere else.
That's very good. I like it. Yeah. No, what do you guys make of this, Anna? Did you have a bit of a chuckle, a giggle?
Yeah, I did. I particularly like that last one. I've prepared a place for you, but just not for you. I must have been so much fun coming up with all those different signs, right? Like, yeah. It's good to have a bit of a laugh.
Oh, it's good to bring it up.
Of the difficulties.
Yeah, people. A bit of sense of humor, you know, have a good Christian joy, you know. Hey, Don, what do you reckon? You reckon we should put some of these in the local Catholic parish?
I don't think it's necessary because 16 years of liberal theology and bad catechesis has already created an environment where the pews are pretty empty by themselves.
Don, how do you take even the light story? I personally think that some of these were a little bit too neo-Marxist, and I think that the problem. Oh, we love you, Don. You're fantastic.
5,000-person food bank that Jesus set up. That's
right. Yes. Right. Well, if you want to go back and listen to see if our humour was any better in the previous episodes, you can go check them all out at www.station15.co.nz. You can subscribe there for free. Or you can go find it. I don't know why I think we would charge. You can go subscribe for free on our website, or you can go and find us in iTunes or Spotify or Google Podcasts or wherever good podcasts are found. Just search for The 15th Station. If you'd like to drop us a note, we always love to hear from you. Send us an email to podcast@station15.co.nz. I think sometimes I say feedback at station15.co.nz. They both work. Or you can find us at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Just leaves me to say thanks very much, Don. It's always good to talk to you, buddy.
Likewise.
And thank you, Anna. Always wonderful to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gavin. Thanks for all your work getting us together again, as per usual.
Thank you, James. We'll have a couple of election results to speak about next month.
Oh, it's going to be a bumper episode next month, so tune in. But until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.